Welcome to Dialogue Across Difference, an event series hosted by the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Join us as Center Director Larry Jacobs and guests engage in conversations across the political and policy spectrum on issues of the day.
I want to welcome everybody. I would first acknowledge some special guests here. Mike McFadden, who was the Republican 2014 U.S. Senate candidate against Al Franken. We're pleased to have Representative Kristen Robbins, who is the ranking member of the House Education Committees. We have University of Minnesota Regents James Farnsworth. Thank you so much for coming. He's one of my bosses. Jake Loesch is here, just announced as the president of the Citizens League in Minnesota, well-regarded and important civic organization. So, without further ado, I'm Professor Larry Jacobs, and I direct the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs, which is the university's School of Public Affairs. I'm very pleased to welcome you to today's program, Parents Matter, with Virginia Secretary of Education, Amy Cadera. I'm also joined by my co-moderator, Vin Weber, and we have started a series called Conservative Voices at the Humphrey School. This is a lecture series that is geared to highlight prominent conservative thinkers and public officials. And the point is to engage in a conversation. Questions are raised. This is not just the platform. It's meant to be a conversation. And it also serves the center's mission, which is to generate dialogue across difference. That is our mission. All of you who are joining us online, you are an important part of this conversation. Please participate. You'll see there's a button at the bottom of your screen called Q&A. That's your entree into this conversation. Those of you who've come to our events before know that we are very eager to get your questions. If they are challenging questions, even better, please send them along and we're going to get to as many as possible. There's also a live captioning feature if that is something you're looking for. So let me introduce our special guest today, Madam Secretary Amy Cadera. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Madam Secretary has had her office since 2022. She oversees This is quite a platform. Oversees pre-K to post-secondary education in Virginia. This is a lot more than what's going on in Minnesota in terms of the education secretary. You are the boss when it comes to education in Virginia. It's a pleasure to have you. And those of us who have been following Secretary Cadera's career know it is an impressive one and a long one. In 2012, Time Magazine named her one of the 12 education activists of the year. She serves on many boards. She was founder and president and CEO of Data Quality Campaign that is committed to improving the quality of information available to students, parents, and educators. She's also on the advisory board of the Harvard Center for Education Policy Research. Secretary Cadera has a bachelor's degree from Princeton University and a master's degree from Harvard's Kennedy School of Public Affairs. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. And I just, before we dive into questions, I want to say it's just so nice to be back in Minnesota. And it's awesome. You know, I have two public policy degrees. And so I feel like I'm at home here at the Humphrey School. So thank you for having me back. And it's also just so nice to see friends here in the audience. I want to do a shout out to what you all are doing. It matters so much in terms of creating these forums.
Thank you.
For bringing together voices and listening to each other. It's something that should be a hallmark of every school at every level, is how do we listen to each other? How do we learn? How do we get uncomfortable by being exposed to ideas that we haven't before? And what you all are doing should be a model for the rest of the nation. And I also want to take the time to shout out YIG, Youth in Government, at the YMCA. And if you're not familiar with YIG, you should know about it. It is an incredible program for helping our young people also model that by coming in and taking over the government for a week every year. And I have to tell you that when I would ever go to YIG and go and see it, I felt like most of our legislators should go and watch what happens at the Capitol when our young people are down there, because they treat it with decorum and respect, and they are great listeners, and they learn how to work together. So I want to say thank you to YIG and what you all do at the Y to support this just intellectual diversity and freedom of expression, which is core to our education, core to our development of our youth, and absolutely central to our democracy. So thank you.
I'm glad you used the word decorum. That's sort of the news this week.
Absolutely. I'm glad we're all dressed appropriately, too. So there you go. So it's good.
Vin, do you want to start out?
Sure. I'd go to a pretty basic question, but you know, we have seen the parental rights movement, maybe it's fair to say started in the state of Virginia, or at least was highlighted in Governor Youngkin's campaign. But it's now spread all across the country, and we see bits and pieces of it across the state of Minnesota. And some states are promoting what they call parental bill of rights, and they're controversial, but you know, they're gaining momentum. I just would like you to talk a little bit about that. Is it a good idea? What are the pitfalls? What are the advantages? And how should we approach that concept of a parental bill of rights?
Sure. So, you know, parents matter. It was a hallmark of Governor Youngkin's campaign, and it continues to be a hallmark of what we do every single day. Governor Youngkin, since the campaign and since day one, has been all about restoring excellence to education. And you cannot do that without listening to parents and hearing their concerns, hearing their ideas, and involving them not just at the being at the table, but being at the head of the table. In Virginia, unlike a lot of places, parents' rights are already ensconced in our Constitution and in statute. And so a lot of what we've been doing is reminding people that parents have these rights to be the champion of their children and to be the defender and to be the main decision maker according around their well-being, their education, and their health decisions. Mm-hmm. And so we're blessed in Virginia that it is a right that is already part of what we do and who we are. And yet what we've done in Virginia is remind people that we've passed several pieces of laws and executive directives that, one, reinforce the importance of parents having access to information, greater transparency about their child's test scores immediately, to be alerted to bullying allegations within 24 hours, to have the ability to review curriculum and materials used in classrooms. So we were really building on those basic rights that parents have in Virginia and building a culture of partnership, of transparency, and empowerment. But the most important thing is, how do we make sure that we are building a partnership between teachers, parents, and students? One of the parts how I started in this whole world, I spent a year in Japan teaching right after my undergraduate years. And it was an amazing experience to work in five high schools in Japan. And I brought back many, many things. But one of the things that sticks with me the most is the Japanese concept of a three-legged stool on which student success rests. And they have a beautiful way of saying that I will not try to say in English nor in Japanese. But it's a concept that parents, teachers, and students themselves need to be the three legs of the stool. And that in a case where one of those legs of the stool is non-existent or is shaky, the other two need to work together and balance it and to make sure that student success does not falter. We need to embrace that in this country and build the partnership between parents, teachers, and students. And this whole student agency piece really matters. And in Virginia, we start with information. How do we make sure that everybody knows where a child is? And then how do we make sure that every child has what they need to get ahead and that we see parents and teachers being really important partners in that effort?
And yet, to go back to your initiatives in Virginia, I don't want to bring up negative subjects, but Fairfax County, Virginia, has resisted blatantly defied your initiatives. Can you tell us a little bit about how that developed and what's the basis of their opposition and how are you dealing with it?
So there's opposition to some model policies we put out and decisions. And first of all, we are using the bully pulpit a lot and reminding parents that they have these rights. Two, we are doing more at the state level to ensure that we are making sure that every parent has access to information. So for the first time ever in Virginia history, every parent last June received their students' history, their longitudinal history of their assessment results. And it was the same information in clear English about your child is not on track or success, or your child's 4 years ahead in math. And here are conversations that we encourage you to have with your teacher. And that every teacher of every student received the same piece of paper of every parent. And that had never happened before in Virginia. So part of this is about how at the state level, do we ensure those conversations are happening that aren't happening, that people have the information that they have, and how do we also start providing the questions and the conversation starters that we think the parents need to really incent conversations to be happening at the local level, even in places where we think the local divisions aren't providing that access to information and to what we think parents need.
Is just one last question on this topic. Is the main source of opposition to these kinds of initiatives, does that come from the teachers' unions mainly? That's what people in my party would say. Or are we oversimplifying by saying it's the teachers' unions?
So, you know, throughout my career, I have always said I will work with anybody who wants to focus on making sure that every child has a shot at succeeding, and we know that all kids can learn at high levels. Probably the most frustrating conversations I've had in my career and that continue in Virginia are with the unions. I'm not really sure that the unions actually are focused on making sure every child succeeds. They're an organization that serves the adults. So, yes.
Thank you.
Obviously, all of us have been following what's going on in Virginia. It's so important in the area of education. And it's also been clear that there's a debate going on. And I just want to read you from the comments of a black mother of two children attending a Virginia school who was concerned that the grievances of white parents with critical race theory was elevated. And here's her quote. I hear a lot of white mothers say they think their child is too young to learn about racism. You know what? My child's too young to experience it. So is the policy that you're pursuing giving more emphasis to the concerns of white parents, so let's say with critical race theory, than the concerns of black parents?
So Governor Youngkin signed 10 executive orders on his first hour in office in January 2022. And the first one was to stop the teaching of divisive items, including critical race theory. And there was a lot that was going on in Virginia before we arrived that it was just not appropriate, and that people would shake their heads. Everything from privilege bingo and seeing everything through a race lens and making decisions and blaming, ascribing guilt to children for something that people did 200 years ago. And we said, enough. This is distracting us from focusing on the fact that kids cannot read and they can't do math, and it's wrong. And this issue that by doing that we are not teaching all of our history and not acknowledging that there are issues of race that still need to be dealt with is completely not the whole story. And so one of the things that the governor came into office saying is that we were going to revise our history standards, which we do, as Minnesota does, on a schedule, and it was time for the history standards to be revised. And he said, we will, one, have the best history standards in the country, and two, we will teach all of our history in Virginia, the good, and the bad. Those history standards were just adopted last year, this past spring, unanimously. And for the first time, to address that woman's quote, for the first time in the history of Virginia, every Virginia child will learn that the primary reason for the Civil War was slavery. They will learn for the first time about massive resistance, which was a horrific period of time in Virginia where there was mandated segregation. They're going to learn about things that they never did before, and that came in through a Republican administration and because of the leadership of Glenn Youngkin. So we are being very open about the good and the bad of history and talking about what needs to. But the other thing I would say to that mom, if she were here, is that we have not been honest with ourselves about how ill-served our children who have traditionally not been doing well in school continue to be. Virginia, like Minnesota, by average, looks really good. Our strong students continue to make everybody look better than they are, and that we have unbelievable gaps. And our black, our brown kids, our students with English language learners and special needs are just continue to fall further and further behind. And this is one of the pieces that why we're using data is to make sure that we see every child, that we don't mask it by using averages, and that we make sure that we're getting them what they need. So to me, that's the conversation, right? Is how do we start drawing attention to the fact that our students who are traditionally underserved continue to be that, and how do we do a better job of meeting every child? That's what we're focused on, is making sure every child gets what he or she needs.
Can we talk a little bit more about that? Because as I'm sure you know, Minnesota has one of the largest gaps in the country,
yes,
racially, and they're trying, the state's trying to address it with phonics and teaching teachers how to teach science and things like that. Any advice? Just what?
I have lots of advice. Go visit all in Virginia at our Department of Education website. So, you know, Virginia and Minnesota are really, really similar. There are two states who have been just vaunted leaders in education, both in higher education and K-12. You know, Virginia continues to be in the top five, often one or two in higher education, as does Minnesota. And in our K-12 system with NAEP, which is the nation's report card, we're consistently seen as being a great state. We came into office saying we're restoring excellence to education, and people were like, how dare you? We're Virginia. We are excellent. And I said, this is what we're going to talk about, data. When you disaggregate the data, you find out that we also have the large gaps in Virginia. We also can show that with the NAEP scores last year, and it mirrored all of our state test scores, Virginia had the largest learning loss in the nation, by three times the horrific national average in our fourth graders in English and in math, the largest loss. We basically erased 20 years of progress over the last 5 years, and this was done by just a systemic unraveling of a culture of high expectations. So what are we doing, and what can Minnesota learn from this? We are unapologetic with having a focus on high expectations for every child. So we, over the period of time that we're in office, will now go through and revise every single one of our critical standards to make sure that they are best in the nation, mm-hmm. that they are benchmarked to the needs of higher education and to the business community and to military. We are taking our definition of proficiency, which is the lowest in the country, in math and in reading, we're just right above Puerto Rico. So just think about that. This is Virginia, and definition of proficiency is what NAEP, what the U.S. government says is necessary to be successful and on track for success. We just defined it lower than everybody else, right? And this was done by policymakers before we got here who said, well, we're just going to count it here. And there were decisions maybe before we got in office of making it easier to get better scores on our tests. The other piece is we just weren't telling the truth. So why people haven't been focusing on the fact that we're failing a lot of communities is because the messages that our accountability system has shown is everything's okay. So we had this incredible learning loss, and yet our accountability system, which in Virginia is called an accreditation system, not a single school in Virginia is not accredited. So just pause and think about that. So part of this is a change management issue of how do we do a better job of making sure that individual parents, but also our citizens and our taxpayers and our policymakers, and most importantly, our educators, know where every child is, because you can't change what you're doing if you don't know where you are and where you're trying to go. So this along comes a pandemic and just exacerbates everything that was happening before. And the learning loss just continues. So we just announced our latest scores on our state summative assessments. And it's horrific still. We're on the cusp of losing a generation of children. And two-thirds of our third through eighth graders are not on track, are either not proficient or at risk of not being proficient in math, and over half in reading, the same numbers in third to eighth graders. So we just rolled out an all-in Virginia plan. We are providing $418 million in partnership in our new budget deal between the General Assembly and the governor. $418 million will go to school divisions. We're encouraging the school divisions to use 70% of that on high-intensity tutoring. So that we're saying in small groups, one-on-one groups, that every child who is not proficient or at risk of being proficient will receive 3 to 5 hours a week for either half a year if you're at risk or for an entire year. Because we know from the data that the only thing that can really expedite and accelerate this learning, not just addressing learning loss, but accelerating learning gain, is this intensive tutoring that's happening. Second piece is we are gonna put 20% of these division dollars into addressing the huge problem with attendance. We have one-fifth of our children in Virginia, and I know you had the same issue here in Minnesota, are just not showing up at school. The message is school doesn't matter. We've gotten used to being home in our pajamas, and that number doubled over the last 4 years. So we now have 1 in 5 children in Virginia is not coming to school 2 days a month or 10% of the school year. And that just is, we know that that correlates to horrific learning loss. And the third thing is we are going to be addressing the whole issue of how do we expedite and accelerate the implementation of our Virginia Literacy Act, which again, the representative is Kristen Robbins is working on a similar act here in Minnesota that you all should support, because we know that if you're not teaching the science of reading, also known as phonics, kids mm-hmm. are not learning. And that's been one of our issues, is that we have not been using the data-based approach. So those are the things I would say, and it's basics, right? Focus on tutoring and having consistent relationships with kids, focus on attendance, and focus on making sure that we are teaching the science of reading.
And when you get into these policies, which all makes sense to me, you have to take money away from other things, don't you?
I would argue that it should be a laser-like focus on getting to those three things, yes.
Okay.
Secretary Gadara, let me ask you about comments you made when you were presenting the department's report detailing lagging achievement in schools back in May 2022, where you called out policymakers for fostering, quote unquote, a general culture of just lowering expectations, close quote, by prioritizing racial equity in the Commonwealth. What's the connection between those two, between DEI and the emphasis of racial equity and student performance?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, my boss, the governor, believes deeply in focusing on diversity, opportunity, and inclusion. We renamed the statutory required office of the Office of Diversity and Equity and Inclusion into DOI because he thinks those three pieces matter, and opportunity is at the heart and soul of what this country is about. And the word equity is a damaged word. I know we were talking before about it's terrible that we can't use words, but equity means something different to everybody. And in lots of ways, it was encompassing what I consider a lot of distracting things that were happening in classrooms and wrong things, ascribing guilt to children, or also lowering expectations for kids, right? One of the things that we were also seeing that in the name of equity, schools were lowering their expectations for children, which is just wrong, right? And to make all kids feel like that they had a shot forward or they were doing better, we're going to tell them that, oh, you don't need to read at this level because it makes you feel badly, right? That's incredible. The way if you want to serve all kids and make sure that we are preparing all students for success, which is what I wake up every day thinking about, we need to provide the dignity to every child and every family to say, we are going to hold you to high expectations, and then we're going to work with you to get there. And so this focus on equity rather than a focus on excellence is part of what happened in Virginia. We just got distracted, and in the name of equity, we lowered expectations, we took our eye off the prize, we forgot to realize that our job is to make sure that every child can read, every child can do math, and every child is prepared for success, and that we're not going to lower the bar because to make kids feel better, but we're going to have a culture of merit and a culture of hard work, and we're going to reward excellence, and we're going to incent excellence. One of the things I'm really excited about is the Fordham Institute just put out a really interesting report looking at how do we rethink access to advanced education, you know, what we used to call gifted and talented. There's a moment here of how do we do the hard work rather than changing admission standards at college level to actually work with children in preschool and in kindergarten and work with them to get everybody ready so we don't need to move the goalposts, but we make sure that everybody is ready to get to those goalposts.
So just to be clear, you're arguing that the investment in targeting students of color who were lagging in school and building programs that would help students to feel comfortable and that they were their past and history being recognized, that is a cause of lower student performance? Is all that?
That's putting words into what I said. What I'm saying is...
Yeah. I'm trying to understand in fairness.
A huge part of education and any kind of valuable endeavor is relationships, right? And so part of what we know that the data shows around high intensity tutoring is one of the most important parts of it that data has proven is the consistency of the relationship of the tutor and the person getting tutoring. That's about support. That's about building relationships. That's about building trust. Those are all things that are really important in education, right? That's the heart and soul of what we learned during COVID is that it's, sure, we can get educated through screens, but it's different when you can't build a relationship. And we know we can do it through screens, but it's so much better to have that relationship piece. So it's not saying that we're not going to acknowledge where kids are coming from and backgrounds and all that. That's what makes life interesting too, right? Is that we all have different backgrounds and the relationships. What it's saying is you can't say that's all that matters and that we're not also going to focus on academics.
But the backgrounds of students of color doesn't require particular attention given the history of this country?
So one, I respond that every child's background requires. If I am a teacher and I have a child coming in who I don't care what color they are, I don't care what their background is, and if they can't read, my job as a teacher is to meet them where they are and get them where they need to go. Mm-hmm. So the background cannot be an excuse for making sure that every child's prepared. Great teachers understand where kids are coming from and they meet them where they are. And that's what we're also supporting in Virginia. How do we make sure that every child has a great teacher who's going to support them, invest in them, and get them where they need to go?
Great. Thank you.
I wonder if we can talk, I expect we're going to go to online questions pretty soon, but can you talk first a little bit about the burgeoning school choice movement around the country And some of the different innovations that are coming out of that movement. You know, Minnesota had a role in that with charter schools.
Yeah.
But I'm particularly interested in this movement toward micro schools.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me what you think about that and where you think that's going.
Right. So I'll tell you, our data shows us one-size-fits-all education does not work. It works for nobody. And in Virginia, we have probably the country's worst charter law. We have 7 charters. And there's not a lot of choice at this point. We have our great governor schools. We have different options. But one of the things that we are very much promoting is how do we have more options and how do we have multiple pathways? So one of the things I'm most excited about is that we have launched an effort called Lab Schools. And so the General Assembly, in partnership with the governor, put in a $100 million innovation fund last session, 2022, that supports with finances, financial support, the ability for higher education institutions to partner with K-12 systems, with businesses, with community partners, with foundations, to build schools that are really trying to build a better mousetrap. Like, how do we actually meet students who are not doing well in traditional education in the one-size-fits-all, this is just what we're going to do, and explicitly, how do you break down the school walls and get more students and teachers into the world of work, and how do you get the world of work and the world outside of schools into that? So some of these ideas are awesome. You know, Wallops Island out on the eastern shore of Virginia is one of the 4 places you can launch rockets in the United States. Eastern, the community college out on the eastern shore is partnering with NASA, Langley, all of these wonderful things to build basically a space-oriented school. And they do it for 2 reasons. One, they need to attract people who can work at Wallops Island, and they need to invest in a school where people want to send their kids. And 2, they're investing in the future workforce. And so there's one in Southwest Virginia focused on healthcare, and there's a huge healthcare desert and need down there. And so that they're partnering with all the local hospitals and clinics, 4 years, 2 years schools, and the school divisions to build these. So we're trying to do things. Micro schools is great. We have a scholarship tax credit program that we are trying to blow the caps off of, because we know that that's also working for families who can't pay for choices at this point to do that. So we're trying to expand as many options as possible to make sure that families have and students have options to things. One last thing I'll say on this. This legislative session, the governor wants to start a conversation in Virginia about how do we ensure that our students have a better idea of pathways out of high school. And how do we do a better job of making sure that we are exposing our children to the world beyond high school, that we're providing experiences outside of that, and that we're providing opportunities to build expertise. And so one of the things that we're going to say is, what if we were to say that it's not enough anymore to just graduate with a high school diploma? We're calling it Diploma Plus, and we're saying every student who graduates from Virginia should also have an industry-recognized credential or some college credit or some experiences in the world of work, because that's how we know dreams will get bigger, people will be prepared, and the pathways will become more apparent. So we're about blowing up the system that has not been serving for so many kids.
In that context, you know, there's a lot of discussion about rethinking higher education and rethinking the value of a simple 4-year liberal arts degree. People are talking more about apprenticeships and technical college. How do you feel about that?
I think we need to have a complete reset on higher ed. You know, we just finished doing 6-year planning conversations with all of our 15 4-years, and we have 23 community colleges that are under the Secretary of Education. And there needs to be a laser-like focus on outcomes. You know, when I talk about the purpose of education, it's threefold. Higher ed and K-12. Our education system should be preparing people to be productive members of our economy. We should be prepared to be informed members of our democracy and engaged members in our pluralistic communities. And part of this is, how do we start saying that getting a degree in 6 years, our rates of doing that are terrible across higher education. They are here in Minnesota, they are in Virginia, they're across the nation. We need to start calling success means that you get a credential as quickly as possible at the least amount of debt, and that you're able to get a job. And so in Virginia, we're going to start reporting on that this year, that we will report out on our websites exactly how long it takes everybody who came in, how long it took them to get a credential, did they get a job, at what wage level, and then follow over time. So part of this is a reset of what is the purpose of education and where do we get that return on investment.
We've got, just want to remind folks, we want your questions. We've already gotten some coming in. Send more. We'll be passing out cards to all of you here to get your questions into this conversation. Let's turn to sexuality, which has gotten wrapped up into this conversation about reform in Virginia. And there's been, you know, a conversation about requiring schools to notify parents if their children are changing their names or their pronouns. And there's been concern about that, criticism of it, that by doing that, it's violating the privacy of students, it may lead to bullying, it may lead to the ostracizing of those students at home or in their faith communities. How have you tried to balance that issue?
So I would encourage everyone to read the model policy because it says something a little bit different than that. What it says that if a child wants to be called by a different name or do that, that there needs to be a written note from a parent to do that. So it does not require telling parents. It's that when there's an action that wants to be changed in the school, that that's what it
is. But that would require the parent to know that there's going to be a change.
Yes.
And the, I think the concern is by going through that process, it's in effect outing students who may not be at a point where they're publicly talking about this transition, and that could lead to, you know, the bullying and the outing and the ostracizing.
So our policy is really clear. It's called a model policy to ensure the privacy, dignity, and respect and confidentiality of every student in Virginia. And so it is very well written, I believe, and is a model for the country, talking about, one, that we are protecting the rights of students and their safety and the security, and there's all kinds of conversations about how to do that. As I mentioned, we have a new law in effect that every parent must be alerted to any allegations of bullying their child within 24 hours, that we have all kinds of already protections in law that if a child is at risk, if something happens, that a parent doesn't need to be notified. And there's also, again, I'll go back to the theme of this talk, parents matter. Yeah. You know, if my children were going through the biggest question in their life, which is to change their identity, you better believe I want to be part of that conversation, right? Okay. And I think it'd be really hard to find a parent who does not want to be part of that conversation. And to say that a teacher knows better or that someone in a school knows better than I do as a mom, I would have a very hard time with it. And it turns out the vast majority of Americans and Virginians believe the same thing.
Okay, so that I think is a very clear articulation of it. And one of the reasons that the critics have stepped forward saying, what are the consequences of that? I understand your position and the position of others that there ought to be, you know, this parent notification. But for the child who's going through, a student who's going through a transition, it can have consequences for them.
And they're still my child, and I'm going to have a seat at that table, and I want to. I am my child's greatest protector, defender, champion, and by law in Virginia, I am also the number one person to make decisions about my child. The law is really clear on this.
Great, thank you.
Good.
Let me ask you what one of the issues that's kind of come up in Virginia. It started during the Youngkins campaign, is about which books should be in school libraries and on school syllabi. And during the campaign, a mother pointed to Toni Morrison's Beloved, which is a Pulitzer Prize winning novel, and said this book should not be in the library on the syllabi. Other books by Toni Morrison have also been identified, as well as a dozen other authors. And I guess the question here is, why is it that that parent's concern takes priority? Because there are other parents who would say Toni Morrison is a towering figure in American and really global literature, and students ought to be reading her. How do you balance that parent's concern versus the concern of many other parents that Morrison should be in schools because of what she writes about and the power of her literary skills?
It's called democracy, and democracy works. And laws get made when we listen to stakeholders and constituents, and that's what our General Assembly does. And last year, the legislation that went through was not about, there's no state law about what's in libraries. The law that passed last year and that the governor was pleased to sign was about codifying the rights of parents to review materials, including books, that are going to be used in a child's curriculum in a classroom.
Is there an age limit on that?
No, it's throughout K-12. So. And basically looking at it and have a request to review it. And again, in the spirit of transparency, that's an important thing, right? As a mom, I want to see what my child is experiencing, what they're being exposed to. And then have the ability, much like we all did when our children were going through sex ed classes, of saying I'm going to opt out and have my child choose to do something else. So that's a very different thing than what's being portrayed in the news of banning books and taking things off and changing libraries. You know, it's a very specific piece about what a child's going to be exposed to in a classroom. And the people of Virginia, like the people of Minnesota, come together and they create laws that reflect what they want. So this issue of listening to some parents and not others, I would argue that's how democracy works. We hopefully listen to everybody, and that's right. How we have a voice, and elections matter.
Yeah, so Republicans got elected to the governor's office and continue and now control the House. The Democrats are in right. the Senate, and this is what happens.
And that law came through in right. a split chambers, right? So there were enough people who agreed that that was an appropriate thing to do on both sides of the aisle.
We're starting to get questions in from our friends watching us online. Thank you. U.S. literacy rates are low compared to other countries. Black students and indigenous students have much lower literacy rates than the average. Why is it a good use of public resources to focus on cultural issues instead of putting in place literacy programs that work?
So please go to All in Virginia. Please read everything that we're doing in Virginia. I cannot tell you how much time, energy, and money we're putting into reading. The Virginia Literacy Act is a model for the nation. It basically resets the entire law, and that by the 2024-25 school year, it will be illegal to teach anything other than the science of reading in Virginia. This is how we're going to solve it. If you haven't listened to Sold a Story, the podcast about how we got into this horrific place in this country and why other nations continue to do okay and we don't, watch it, listen to it. It's amazing. And what we're trying to do is say, of course we know how to teach our kids how to read. We have the science of it. We have the data. And everything we do in Virginia, and this was a bipartisan piece of legislation, and it literally says we're going to train our teachers differently. We're going to make sure that all of our schools of education are training our teachers in the science of reading. We are only going to allow materials to be in the classroom aligned to it, and we're going to provide coaches. So I would argue to the person, I wish they were here, we are spending a lot of time on reading, and it's the right place to put our time, energy, and money.
What is the resistance to that? It seems to me that that is not an issue with, like, some of the other things we talked about mm-hmm. that gets into gender and race right. and things like that. What's the resistance to that?
So it is such a great piece. You know, I've been doing education policy for 35 years, and the hardest thing to change is the status quo in education. It's just the way we've always done it, or this is how I was taught to read, and even when you show people the data and say, but what you're doing is failing kids, it's yeah. really hard to tell somebody that what they're doing is wrong. And so it's just been so baked into our soup to nuts teacher training. The publishing industry is a huge part of this, that they published a lot of books that were not done the right way, did not reinforce phonics. And if you really want, seriously, listen to the Sold a Story podcast, because it explains that entire issue of how the heck did we get to this point when it's so clear that there is a way to teach kids to read that works and one that doesn't. But again, for me as a data wonk, it makes me really pleased to know that, you know, that, let me put it this way, that data matters, right? So we've never made decisions in the education sector based on research and data, because we're all experts. Well, I went to school, or I taught to school, or Aunt Bessie's a teacher. And so we all have this experience with education, and we think we just know how to do it. Turns out data matters. Data matters to help us realize where children are and what we need to do, but also the data can tell us what works and what works with specific kids in specific places. And we do not have a culture in education that values and knows how to use information. And that's what we're trying to change in Virginia. How do we grow those muscles and strengthen them to use information to identify where kids are and where we need to get them, but also how do we retrain our teachers, our policymakers, our educators to use data as a tool of continuous improvement?
It's tough.
It's really tough. Yeah. It's the greatest challenge we have to just doing it the way education looked when I was a kid.
Right.
It's huge. It's hugely hard.
Another question from our friends in the audience here. Some of the research shows that when students of color are being taught by teachers of color, it can have a positive impact. What is the percentage of teachers who are Black, Indigenous, or people of color in Virginia, and what's the plan to improve that?
So that data is really important data, and it's too low. I want to say it's like 10 to 12%, but don't quote me on that. So the superintendent of schools, just is putting out over the next 2 months $29 million to address teacher shortages and to ensure that we have to continue to grow a great teacher corps. You know, our goal in Virginia is to have to attract, to grow, and to retain the world's greatest teaching force, because we know from the data that after a mother's educational level, the most important determinant of a child's achievement is having a quality teacher. This is just like a no-brainer, and this is why teachers matter so much, and it's why, one, we have all kinds of conversations going on about what we can do to create incentives for for having our greatest teachers teach in our hardest to serve schools and to meet those students who need the most. Because right now the data also shows us that our students who are furthest behind are the ones that have access to the teachers who are not as experienced or not getting the same results. How do we start thinking differently about rewarding performance? How do we reward teachers who are willing to teach in the hardest to serve subject areas? So we're really focused on how do we do that, but also the pipeline piece, right? So teacher residencies and grow your own programs. And there's a grant for helping students who traditionally have not been going to the teaching force to do that, especially our students who we need in our neighborhoods because they look like the students that they're going to teach. So it's something we're very focused on, and we're putting money behind it as well.
A question from the audience. What specific steps is your administration taking to address racial gaps and providing equal access to opportunities to all students, including those of color?
Everything we do is about that. So that's everything we're doing. We're about how do we create equal access to opportunity, right? And that's the conversation we're having. And this is the whole point. We're going to redo our accountability system so we actually have a better picture of which schools are not serving which kids. And then we're gonna make sure we work with those schools to figure out how do we learn from the data and from evidence about what we can do to make sure that every single child is on track for success. The gaps are huge. I am the skunk in the garden party all the time of going and saying, this is not good enough, these kids are not being served, and we are gonna continue to lead by using data and reminding people that yes, there's excellence in schools in Virginia, but there's not access to excellence for every family. And that's what we're trying to change. And we're changing that by investing in what works. We're changing that by trying to create this force of urgency around changing the status quo, mm-hmm. because the status quo right now is that we're failing consistently kids who have been traditionally underserved, but we're now failing them worse. All of our gaps are getting bigger, like here in Minnesota. And it's a moral issue, right? This is just a moral issue that we are losing this generation of kids. So we're focused with a laser.
We have been spending a lot of time talking about K-12 education, mm-hmm. and I assume that often happens when you're doing a public talk. Talk a little bit about post-secondary education, universities, community colleges. What's your orientation there?
So I mentioned this a little bit before. You know, we are entering this crisis that's coming, this great upheaval, as it's being called in higher education, that's going to happen across the nation. We're entering this period of great upheaval in a position of strength in Virginia. We've got great schools. They're with great, you know, the rankings all just came out. You can argue with the rankings, but Virginia did really well. And yet there needs to be change. There needs to be this focus on outcomes and results. And to me, as I said before, the outcomes and results need to be able to get a job. And I say this not as an attack on the liberal arts. I'm a liberal arts kind of girl. My entire family went to college as a liberal arts. I'm married and a mother of three English majors. This is not an attack, but I expect them all to have jobs, right? So this is the bottom line. Is that we need to do a better job of connecting education and work and making sure that our students know how do you connect what you're learning with what you need to do to earn and how do we build those pathways. So some things going on in Virginia I'm really excited about are VTOPs, or Virginia Talent Opportunity Partnership. We're making it an expectation that if you graduate from a four-year or two-year school in Virginia, you will have had a paid work experience as part of that experience. Why? Because we know that this is, one, the way to get those pathways cemented in and for our students to be exposed to the world of work and to start building relationships. But we also know from our employers that they're more likely to hire someone they had an internship with. And we're really open. Our goal is to attract the smartest people into Virginia, educate them, and then keep them there to be part of our economy. And so it's really a simple equation, right? Is do everything possible to build that connection point with the workforce while you're still in school and then make it impossible for you to leave because it's such a great place. And this was the governor's tagline in his campaign, making Virginia the greatest place to live, to work, and to raise a family, and to get educated.
And what's the role of businesses in that? Because obviously, if you're oriented towards getting jobs, you want to be hearing from employers about here's where the jobs are, but as importantly, here's where they're going to be coming from.
So business is critical to all of this, right? So one, VTOPS is in partnership with our Chamber of Commerce. And so we are putting this together and as a partnership between the business community and the public policy and the higher education institutions. And by the way, we want our private schools to do this as well. So I was talking to all of our private colleges and universities last week with the governor, and they're doing this equally. But it's also, we have the business community informing everything that we're doing. So building business advisory groups, having them be part of the review panel, that when we look at our standards and we revise our standards of learning every 7 years, making sure that we have business leaders looking at them and say, yes, this is, these are the exits, the requirements that we need to hire somebody in, and making sure that it's aligned with what our exit standards are from high school, are aligned to what the entrance requirements are for our most needed works. And the really cool thing we've got going on in Virginia is, I would argue, we're on the cusp of having the greatest labor market information analysis system in the country. Virginia Office of Economic Education is launching this year, and we are going to be able to provide regional information to every higher education institution and K-12 institution about what the labor market needs are in their region. And what that's going to change is, all of a sudden, starting to think about, what are the programs we need to be expanding? How do we make sure that we are meeting the needs of the economy and knowing that this is going to change exponentially? So business is sitting at the table all the time and really helping us provide that feedback and to help us build what I hope will be the world's greatest talent development system. And you can't do that by just focusing on supply. You've got to talk about demand and how it's related. So there's a lot going on, and it's exciting, and it's great. So internships, exposure, partnership, listening, and they're also, business has been a huge part of our lab schools and our K-12 work of creating internships there, but also rethinking our career and technical education programs as well.
Thank you for all these great questions. 10% of K-12 students are now homeschooled. Is this a good or a bad thing?
Again, if you're putting parents first and students first, then we need to provide as many options as possible. And so I am a big fan of families are going to have different ways that their child is going to thrive, and homeschooling is one of those many, many approaches. So it's something that I personally am very supportive of, and so is our administration.
Are the quality of homeschooling materials, online or written, are they uniformly good, or is there a quality control mechanism so that
there is? So you have to take the assessments and make sure that you're aligned with the standards of learning. And I would argue that one of the bright spots of the pandemic, and there aren't many, is that we also learned how to provide education in lots of different ways. And one of the really cool things, to make it fun and thinking about my bio, so in addition to education from early learning to post-secondary, I also, lots of the really cool historic organizations and museums fall into the secretariat. So one of the cool things is, Jamestown Yorktown Foundation, the Science Museum, the Art Museum, Gunston Hall, which is the home of George Mason, come visit. It's just this amazing thing. And what happened during COVID, that they're used to having all these school kids come in, that they got really good at putting their educational materials online. So one of the things I'm really excited about, which will benefit homeschool students, and they already bring all the homeschool students in, but will benefit all of our students, is that now, on our history standards, we are going to have the standard be able to come alive, so that when you're learning about George Mason and being the father of the Declaration of Rights, which then led to the Bill of Rights nationally, that literally George Mason will put together a lesson plan and make it come alive and show you and walk you around George Mason's Gunston Hall, or at Jamestown Yorktown, where it's just an amazing place to go and learn about the war, but also Fort Monroe, which is the first place that enslaved people set foot in the New World and what became the United States, but also is the first place where enslaved people were also emancipated, that the governor actually taught a lesson that was broadcast across the Commonwealth to fourth graders from Fort Monroe and was able to show exactly where the ships landed. And for kids who live in Southwest Virginia who've never seen the ocean, to be able to be there and watch this broadcast. So I think this moment of how do we make education come alive for our students, we're just on the tip of how we do this. And so I think there's just going to be some exciting things. So it's awesome. So all of those agencies, museums, are all building out learning materials that will make learning come alive for our kids sitting in our classrooms, our homeschool students, and anyone who just at home wants to learn more about the history of Virginia.
Kind of cool. One more question. When I was in Congress, I was on the Education Appropriations Committee, and one of the things that people sort of agreed on left to right in the education debate was that the federal government's research into education was good and helpful.
Yes.
Is that still the case?
So I would argue again, as a purist on this, that the Department of Education's role is to focus on data and to focus on research and to also identify best in class and to help states understand what good looks like. I am a huge fan of the National Assessment for Educational Progress, the Nation's Report Card. Without that, it's a dipstick, right? It is also my quality control, that I know that I can benchmark what we're doing in Virginia against what the nation's report card says and those definitions. So it really matters to have that that part of them.
Good. Thank you.
Question from the audience. Are there areas where the view of educational experts and the data they're producing should take precedent over the opinions of parents?
So again, this is a school public policy, and this is how democracy works. So I'll tell you something I'm really excited about that answers that question. So one of our statutory required work groups that that put together was looking at teacher compensation. So my office and the superintendent's office was in charge of putting together a work group. And we put together a work group that was representative of lots of stakeholders and representative of regional diversity and lots of voices to look at this. And we are going into our third meeting of this work group this week. And I'm giddy because we have somehow convinced the four greatest researchers and experts on teacher compensation to come together and be our experts on this. And it's so amazing, right? And what's cool with this is that I've got these four unbelievable, like I told somebody who these four guys were, they're like, you got them all to come? I'm like, yes. And they are literally the world's experts on teacher pay and the impact on teacher shortages and on student achievement. And they've written a paper and they've put together all the research. And so I literally have this 10-page paper that I'm going to share with all these stakeholders. And this is how we make good policy. I'm bringing the data, I'm bringing the research, I'm bringing the experts in, and then I'm bringing together a group of very balanced stakeholders that are not just with one viewpoint to grapple that and listen. But before I brought in the experts, we said, what's happening in Virginia first? And so we highlighted different school divisions that were doing things and what had happened before. And then people reflected on it. And then together, we're going to put together recommendations to the legislature. So it's a yes and. You know, we need to listen to people. We need to look at what the data says always, right? You need to change this pattern in education of like, oh, it feels good, or the wind's blowing this way, and instead go back to the data because we just have to do that. But it's a yes and you need judgment and human judgment, and you need data together.
So we've been talking about the parents' rights, and I've been giving you some helpful questions reflecting a range of views. And I want to go back to that, but take it in a slightly maybe different way. Though initially, this might be a question that you've heard before. It seems that politicians championing parents' rights and forgetting about parents like me. I want my sons to read as much as possible, including books about gay people and about slavery and about the abuse of black people in America. What are you doing to protect my parental rights?
By definition, that's what parent rights are about. It's respecting the rights of all parents. And again, I would invite that person to go and read our history standards and to also, I don't want to repeat myself, but yes, parents have the right to make decisions about what their child does and are involved, and we're listening to all parents. And
even though the policy sometimes looks like it's veering to one side of this debate than the other.
Yes, and this is why school board meetings are places where people are coming together. And I have to tell you, it's a good thing for parents to go to school board meetings. It's a good thing for all of us as taxpayers and citizens to be at school board meetings because a lot of really important decisions get made there.
They're getting much hotter.
They are getting hotter, and this is where I also go back to that Japanese belief that when we put our children first and we also role model what civility and listening to each other looks like, good things will happen. And we need to remember to be civil. And part of this, I'll just get on my soapbox about this, civics education matters, understanding how democracy works, and that's another part I'm really proud of in our history standards, that we enhance the coverage of civics and understanding of government and working in every single grade level. And so I would argue it's also one of the strongest things across the country, standards around civics education, but also civility, right? One of the things you asked about higher education that we're also focused on is how do we, like you all are doing, really focus on the importance of creating a culture that defends, protects, and nurtures a culture that is set on diversity of ideas, freedom of expression, and that needs to be in all of our education. And when we start doing that, it will change how school board meetings work because we will start role modeling. It's what we see at YIG, right, in terms of the students actually living those values up with youth in the government.
I want to share a perspective from a Muslim parent, and this is from May 2023 in Osseo. And this parent said, with regard to some of the policies in schools about sexuality and the transgender transitioning going on with some students. This parent said, "We believe the education system should be neutral for kids to learn math, science, and read. And then the sexual orientation should be left to the family, period." And one of the things that's really struck me is sometimes we get into this kind of partisan lens, or we get into a lens of white and black. And of course, that's not the story. There's a lot of breakdown of those well-known kind of fissures in America. Have you experienced that? Are you seeing Democrats, are you seeing communities of color coming forward supportive of what you're doing?
Mm-hmm.
So Could you talk a little bit about that?
So that's what we're doing, right? The press keeps wanting to talk about all the divisive things. And when you follow what we're doing, we are focusing on raising expectations for every child. We are putting in the resources, the time, the focus to make sure, as that mom says, that we are making sure kids know how to read and write and do math, and making sure that we're differentiating and prioritizing more resources and tools and information to the schools that need it the most and for the kids who need it the most. So very aligned with that. And so, yes, so I'm not so, and there are lots of parents who come from lots of different backgrounds who are like, amen, let's do this. Right. And if you, you know, all the surveys show that 80% of Americans and Virginians, and I'm sure Minnesotans, are all saying yes. And it's these the ends of the tails that are wagging all of these divisive things that are distracting us from focusing on making sure that our children are prepared for life.
So let me come back to this issue about reading and math and kind of the technical skills, which we've been talking about. One of the viewers says, should schools, public schools, should be they be teaching virtue?
Virtue?
Values and virtue. Because we've been talking a lot about we got to bring students up in terms of their reading scores, their math scores. And this person is saying, okay, that's fine. But where does virtue and values come from? Does that have a role in public schools or not?
So that's what great books and great literature are all about. I mean, I think it's hard to have a great education without having those values and those things be part of it. So, yes, and lots of the parent research says that they're expecting schools to do that. So I would recommend to everyone who cares about parents to look at an organization called Learning Heroes, which does polling of parents and listening to them. And just the polling information is amazing. Most parents don't have a clear understanding of where their children are in terms of academic piece, and so why it's so important for teachers and parents to work together and to build that trust. There's already trust, right? We know that parents trust teachers, and that's where they get their information. That's a great thing. And how do we help our teachers know how to communicate with parents? But we also know from that research at Learning Heroes that parents are also expecting schools to do that and to talk about how to be a responsible member of a community, how to listen well, how to work together, the life skills that we know, that there is actually an expectation for most parents, and the research backs this up constantly, that is part of being educated means and what they're looking to schools to do.
Unfortunately, we're running out of time. I want to thank my co-moderator, Vin Weber.
Thank you.
All these events are things that Vin and I talk about, plan for, so I'm grateful to Vin for being part of this, a key part of this. And Secretary Amy Gadara, thank you so much for this great conversation. Before we go, I do want to make a few quick announcements. We believe that former Trump chair of the Economic Council of Advisors. I've got it all gumbled, but
he Council was, of Economic Advisors.
Council of Economic Advisors. Kevin Hassett will be with us probably in the spring. We're excited. Kevin is very well known as a conservative economist. He's also someone who's a prolific author. And for the geeks out there, he's published 4 articles in the American Economics Review, including while he was doing his advising for Republicans. For geeks like me, I love to hear stuff like that. So he'll be with us. Stay tuned. We've got also a couple other folks who we're working on bringing.
Yeah, we'd hope to have somebody in between now and then.
Yes.
Because Kevin said he couldn't come until spring. And we'd like to get somebody in the winter, but we haven't got a lot.
Yeah, for those of you who don't live in Minnesota, when Vin says spring, he means like April and May. So it's very important. Okay, other programs we've got coming. We've got a terrific nation-leading program in election administration. It's really the top program in the country in terms of numbers of people being trained to move into election administration. We've got a webinar series. The next one is on rural election administration. That's October 11th at 11 a.m. You can find that information on our webpage. We've also got a program, part of our Mondale Dialogue series, looking about at fair housing, which Walter Mondale was a leader in when he was in the U.S. Senate. And it's a terrific panel of experts and folks from the private sector. If you're interested in what we did here today, it will be available in about a day or two. It'll be up as a podcast, and it'll also be on YouTube, and we will send information out to all of you who have registered for this program. Once again, thank you so much, Secretary Amy Guderi.
Secretary, thank you.